WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Mr. Knight, center stage.
Hard Rock returns to prison from the hospital for the criminal insane. Hard Rock was known not to take no shit from nobody, and he had the scars to prove it. Split purple lips, lumped ears, welts above his yellow eyes, and one long scar that cut across his temple and plowed through a thick canopy of kinky hair. The word was that Hard Rock wasn't a mean nigger anymore, that the doctors had bored a hole in his head, cut out part of his brain, and shot electricity through the rest. When they brought Hard Rock back, handcuffed and chained, he was turned loose like a freshly gelded stallion to try his new status. And we all waited and watched, like Indians at a corral, to see if the word was true. As we waited, we wrapped ourselves in the cloak of his exploits. Man, the last time it took 8 screws to put him in the hole. Yeah, remember when he smacked the captain with his dinner tray? He set the record for time in the hole. 67 straight days. Old Hard Rock. Man, that's one crazy nigger. And then the jewel of a myth that Hard Rock had once bit a screw on the thumb and poisoned him with syphilitic spit. The testing came to see if Hard Rock was really tame. A hillbilly called him a black son of a bitch and didn't lose his teeth. A screw who knew Hard Rock from before shook him down and barked in his face. And Hard Rock did nothing, just grinned and looked silly, his eyes empty like knot holes in a fence. And even after we discovered that it took Hard Rock exactly 3 minutes to tell you his first name, we told ourselves that he had just wised up, was being cool, but we could not fool ourselves for long, and we turned away, our eyes on the ground. Crushed. He had been our destroyer, the doer of things we dreamed of doing but could not bring ourselves to do. The fears of years, like a biting whip, had cut grooves too deeply across our backs.
Thanks, Etheridge. Who is that poem based on?
There was one dude, his name was Rock Kincaid. There was 7-8 guys like that. It was in the prison I was in, Danny. But the main guy, his claim to fame was that he once fought Ike Williams. He had once been a boxer, and he's pretty violent, pretty fight all the time. When the guards would come to take him to the hole or something, they'd have to send 5 or 6 of them after him. And they finally, made a vegetable out of it. What can I tell you?
Had you ever seen that before? Is it a lobotomy that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what that. No, I hadn't before I went to prison. In fact, I wasn't familiar with it. I'd never seen. We just got lobotomies and shock treatment is. It's the way they would deal with guys who are violent. I understand now they use pills instead of, I don't think they perform the lobotomies anymore.
What was it which got you into prison?
Armed robbery. I went to prison and I got arrested in 1960 for armed robbery. I stayed in jail a long time, about 18 months. In 62, I was sentenced 10 to 25 years for armed robbery. I got paroled in 1968, and since then I've been mainly saying my poems, conducting workshops around the country.
Were you paroled on the basis of good behavior? Is that?
No, not really. I did 6 years and 8 months, and that's the standard. It's the general time. If you haven't messed up in the joint and everything, you usually let out in 6 years and 8 months.
The term good behavior sort of implies that if you just do what you're told, then that's good behavior. But I've always wondered if that's really oversimplifying it. If it's tough to not mess up, if it's difficult to be somebody who is considered somebody having good behavior?
Oh, sure. You're going to... It's like any institution that has a million rules. You're going to break some of the rules. That generally, if you haven't gotten into no really rough stuff, a lot of violence, but you know, everybody, I would always get busted for gambling and things like that. But if you haven't, you know, consistently, if your behavior has consistently been violent and stuff, then you get bad time.
Were you interested in poetry before prison?
Yeah, I didn't define myself as a poet until I was in prison. The fact is, I was already a poet, and I just didn't know it. I'm primarily a toast teller. There's these long narrative folk poems, and I used to make them up and say them to guys. These poems are generally made up by black males for an all-black male audience, jails, pool rooms, taverns, places like that.
What were the subjects of your toasts in prison?
A lot of them had to do with hustling, the street life, pimps and whores, and some are funny about personified animals, the signifying monkey and toast like that. I'll say one for you as we go along, if you'd like to hear one. Okay, here's one. It's called The Sinking of the Titanic. And another thing about these folk poems is a lot of them are made up like blues around catastrophes, events like that. The Sinking of the Titanic. Say the 4th of May was a hell of a day when the great Titanic began to swing and sway. And Shine ran up from the deck below and said, "Captain, Captain, don't you know there's 3 feet of water on the boiler room floor?" The captain said, "Oh, Shine, go on back. Keep throwing that slack. We got 49 new pumps to keep the water back." So Shine went back and started throwing that slack till the water rose up to his neck. And he ran once again up on the captain's deck and said, "Captain, Captain, don't you know there's now 6 feet of water on the boiler room floor?" Captain said, "Oh, nigga, Shine, go on back. Keep throwing that slack. We got 49 new pumps to keep the water back." So Shine stood there on the deck and he began to think. Say, "This bad mother's bound to sink." See, then a millionaire banker ran on the deck and pulled from his pockets a $1 million check, saying, "Shine, Shine, save poor me, and I give you all the money a black boy needs." Shine looked at the money and then at the sea and said, "Jump in, mother, swim like me." And Shine swam on, and Shine swam on. And then the banker's daughter ran naked on the deck with her pink tits trembling and her pants round her neck, saying, "Shine, Shine, save poor me, and I give you all the loving a black boy needs." Shine said, "Now loving is good, and that's no jive, but you got to swim to stay alive." And Shine swam on, and Shine swam on. Then Shine swam past the preacher, floating on a board, crying, "Save me, nigga, Shine, in the name of the Lord." And the preacher grabbed at Shine's arm and broke his stroke. Shine pulled his shank and cut the preacher's throat. And Shine swam on, and Shine swam on. And when the news hit shore that the Titanic had sunk, Shine was up in Harlem, damn near drunk.
Was Shine the only survivor in that poem, do you think?
Yeah. Once I was reading this poem at the Poetry Center in San Francisco, and I always ask after poetry reading if there are any questions, comments, or confrontations. And a lady walked up and said, "Mr. Knight, see, I think that poem is sexist." I said, "Why, lady?" She said, "Well, the way you're portraying a woman." I said, "I guess a banker could say the poem is anti-capitalist because Shine refused the money. A preacher could say the poem is anti-religion because Shine refused religion." I say the poem is not anti-anything. It's pro-Shine. The poem.
Well, but the point that the woman might have been making is how you talk about women, like you say tits, and it's like her survival is completely dependent on a sexual favor, and she doesn't have a chance to make it or to swim. You know, I mean, there's...
Yeah, I think it could be interpreted like that, but I think the lesson, the point of the poem was that survival. It was presumptuous of her to assume that sex was going to make a difference, just like it was presumptuous of the banker to assume that money, or a preacher could assume that religion is going to save him. You know, and women are cast in, I mean, in this society, women are seen. Sex is one. It's about the only way they have to power in this country. So I don't think the poem is sexist at all.
Were there many toasts that you wrote in prison that were based on other prisoners that you knew or ways of surviving in prison?
Oh yeah, and by the way, that poem, that's just a version. It's a folk poem. I didn't make it up. It's not an individual self-conscious effort like, quote, legitimate poetry is.
Was it very difficult to get the type of privacy or thinking space that you would need to write when you were in jail?
Oh, no. you get plenty of time.
Plenty of time, but I've always assumed not much privacy.
No, nothing. I mean, nothing's ever private in prison. You're constantly monitored, or at least you feel. I think that's why paranoia is so common among prisoners.
Did any of the guards have any interest in your poetry, either as poetry or something potentially subversive?
No. There was one man. He wasn't a guard. He was a teacher in the school and education department. He took an interest. He would bring me in books, and I worked on the prison newspaper at the time. And in the second book is a book of essays, and it's about the prison itself in prose, and it was first published in Italy, and I was sending out parts of the book, and at that time things were censored in the 60s. This was, it was pretty tough, and the deputy warden called me in and said, "You can't send this out." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Why not? It's the truth." He said, "It doesn't matter. You can't send it out." And I smuggled some parts of that manuscript out. But no, I never got any hassle.
Could I ask you to read two of the haikus in the series of haikus that it's a really striking mix of the form of the haiku and what it's about. It's number one and number three.
Okay. I got turned on to haiku by Gwendolyn Brooks. She's one of my teachers, and she used to come down to the joint and visit me, and she brought me some books of haiku. Years later, I asked her how come, she brought me these books, and she said, "Well, I was too wordy. I was using words that were prosy." Okay, a haiku. Eastern guard tower glints in sunset. Convicts rest like lizards on rocks. Morning sun slants cell. Junks stagger like crippled flies on jailhouse floor.
What makes words come alive so that you can put jail in the context of a haiku?
When you're involved in the creative process, you are extremely aware. You are aware of what's going on inside of you, and you're aware of the world outside of you. And now, if I were the lord of some rolling estate and I was involved in the creative process, then I'd be aware of rolling lawns and the larks in the meadows. I think wherever you are, you're going to examine the outside world. It's a poet's prerogative to examine all aspects. So I guess it would seem strange since we are oriented to the haiku being a Japanese form. You know, but you know, I guess it's kind of like transferring.
Could you read the last one on that page? I'd really like that too.
Making jazz swing in 17 syllables ain't no square poet's job.
How did you keep in touch with the world when you were in prison? Did you feel excluded from just what was happening, what was going on, either politically or culturally, or just with, you know, the type of personal growth that one has through a relationship or whatever?
I think I kept in pretty much touch. You see, sometimes we look at prisons as being apart from society. But, you know, when you're in prison, you're still part of the world. You're still part of society. And there are radios and televisions and people coming in. And I think one of the reasons I started to publishing on the page was the need to extend my voice. At that time, there were no telephones and things, and writing next to visiting. Writing was the main vehicle for communication.
Were you able to get many poems out and get them read outside the prison?
Yeah, when I first started sending out poems, man, I'm telling you, Dan, I went like over 2 years receiving nothing but rejects, you know, just rejection. I mean, you're already in prison where you've been rejected by society, and then every day, rejects. And then I started getting poems published, and finally I published a poet, Dudley Randall, wrote and asked me if I had a manuscript, and he asked to see 30 or 40 poems, and I sent him about 60. Yes.
Did you hear from any people who read your poems? Did they realize you were in prison?
Oh, sure. And I got lots of support from other poets, and would send me books and letters and critique my poems. And so I wasn't working in a vacuum. So, and there were other guys in the joint who wrote, musicians. I mainly hung out with artists when I was in the joint.
Could you read the next poem on after watching B.B. King on TV?
After watching B.B. King on TV while locked in number 8 cell, number 5 cage of the Bridgeport, Connecticut State Jail. And now, man, as you stand there in the white glare, the sound I hear from your tuxedoed frame somehow ain't the same that's filled my belly and ears for so many, many years. Yet the pain on your face is the same despite the gloss and the glitter and the fame and the new name, culture. And now, man, with the sound of your songs ringing round these bars in sad procession, I think of a Sonya poem. Blues ain't culture. They sounds of oppression, of the game the man's been running all these years.
What happens, you think, when something becomes officially accepted culture, like a blues man like B.B. King, on TV for everybody to see, and maybe even on The Tonight Show or something like that, or on a public television special. Does it change its meaning for you?
Yes, it changes its meaning to me because the situation, the conditions that produces the blues. America has a great ability to co-opt, to water down. And sometimes I feel that entertaining, to me, art both entertains and enlightens. And when I see art slipping too far over to entertainment, and I feel like an audience are being titillated, and they clap and somehow relate and then go on back, and it's business as usual. You know, say, oh, those poor blacks suffering in Mississippi, ain't that a shame? And then go right back and continue in the same way. I feel like it's been co-opted.
Do you feel betrayed by the people who may have been co-opted? I mean, do they owe anything to anybody? This is what I'm asking.
No. I know that when an artist, and I think I can cite examples, gets too far away from his source and too far away from one's primary audience, I think that the artist loses art.
Do you ever think that might have implications for your own writing? Would that ever be something you'd have to consider?
No, not really. I don't see. And then I think the poetry is a little different. I'm not saying B.B. King has the right any artist to address anybody and to do with his art where he wills and to give it or to share it with anybody. What I was responding to was this labeling of a certain thing as culture, like it's a hip thing to do, and therefore acceptable, and not deal with the political and social things that produces these kind of laments.
Is that something which affects poetry in the sense that to become acceptable you might need academic credentials or you might need to be published or you might need to be many things which are not necessarily directly related to the experience which would provoke you to write a poem? Has that affected you, not having the academic credentials that that a poetry establishment might look for?
No, that hasn't affected me because I, as I say, I was poeting before it was legitimized by any authorities. People, audiences, legitimizes art, and not experts. I never felt threatened. I'm going to poet. Whether the president of Harvard says it's poetry or not, you know what I mean? Reads it, you know.
Can I ask you to read two more poems?
So,
let me mention to people just tuning in that you are Etheridge Knight, the poems which you're reading this afternoon are all taken from a collection of your poems published by Houghton Mifflin, and the title of that collection is Born of a Woman, New and Selected Poems. And there's two other books of poetry which are published by Broadside, and those books are Belly Song and Poems from Prison.
Okay. I'll read It Was a Funky Deal and another poem for me. And I made up this poem, It Was a Funky Deal, the day Malcolm X was assassinated. Malcolm X is one of my heroes. He informed me a lot, influenced me. He's one of my teachers, and I remember I was sleeping in my cell when he was assassinated, and one of the guys called down the range, and and told me he'd been killed. And that night I made up this poem. It was a funky deal. It was a funky deal. The only thing real was red, red blood around his red, red beard. It was a funky deal. In the beginning was the word, and in the end, the deed. Judas did it to Jesus for the same herd, same reason. You made them mad, Malcolm, same reason. It was a funky deal. You rocked too many boats, man, pulled too many coats, man, saw through the jive. You reached the wild guys like me, you and Bird, and that little Leroy cat. It was a funky deal. This next poem is titled Another Poem for Me After Recovering from an OD. Men who go to prison, prisons really don't reform. Reformadores don't reform, and prisons really don't rehabilitate. The recidivism rate is too high. When I first got out of prison, I started using drugs again, and I overdosed, and I made up this poem. I just happened to think of an anecdote that was told to me by Joe Martinez. He was a Mexican-American who had spent 25 years in the various prisons in the country. And he used to tell me all the time, well, Etheridge, I'm living proof that reformatories don't reform. If they did, I wouldn't have had to spend 25 years in one. And he used to tell me the story, and it's titled Rehabilitation and Treatment. The convict strolled into the prison administration building to seek counseling for his personal problems. Inside the main door were several other doors proclaiming doctor, teacher, therapist, custody, and counselor. The convict chose the proper door, inside of which were two other doors, first offender, previous offender. He chose the proper door, and again, two doors, juvenile and adult. He was an adult, and so he went through that door and ran smack into two more doors, Democrat and Republican. He was a Democrat, and so he went through that door and ran smack into two more doors, black and white. He was black, and so he rushed through that door and fell 9 stories to the street. You know what I mean? So that about sums up what I think about prisons rehabilitating. Anyway, here's the poem. Another poem for me after recovering from an OD. What now? What now, dumb nigga, damn near dead? What now? Now that you won't dance behind the pale white doors of death. What now is to be what you want to be, what you supposed to be, or what white America wants you to be, a lame crawling from nickel bag to nickel bag? Be black, brother man, be black and blooming in the night. Be black like your fat brother, sweating and straining to hold you as you struggle against the straps. Be black like your woman, her painted face floating above you, her hands sliding under the sheets to take yours. Be black like your mama sitting in a quiet corner, praying to a white Jesus to save her black boy. What now, dumb nigga, damn near dead? Where is the correctness, the proper posture, the serious love of living now that death has fled these quiet corridors?
Do you think your poems ever put white folks off? I mean, despite themselves, people that admire your poetry, but that there's something that goes up inside somebody's stomach. And not only white listeners, but maybe black listeners, too. You know what I mean?
Do I think that my poems ever put people off?
Yeah, I mean, despite themselves.
I think so. I think sometimes my poems may scratch somebody's belly, you know, but I think generally no. I'm often I run into this labeling of poetry. This is hate poetry, this is protest poetry, this is political poetry, and that's really all a trick bag. Poetry, like any other art, its motivating force is love. And if I was making this example, somebody had labeled Baraka, who's a friend of mine, is a label of protest poetry. And if you're walking down the street with your sister, say Danny, and somebody leaps out of the bushes and attacks your sister, and you kill them, are you killing them because you hate them or because you love your sister? Love is always the and it's just sometimes poets, it's not uncommon. Sometimes songs become howls, screams. One responds to a black poet, a woman poet, and most poets living in this world today, being and writing about roses and sunsets all the time in the face of what's going on in this world. It's pretty narrow. You know, and it's probably a lie, and most people who would read it know it's a lie.
The poem you just read, another poem for me after recovering from an OD, I was wondering, is it painful to recall the experience of being a junkie, being strung out?
Yeah, it's painful and shameful, too. The creative process is painful. Yeah, it's lonely and it's painful in the sense that you are seeking in your communication to be revealing and to examine oneself in relationship to the world and to people are in relationship to one's own self is painful.
What was your life like when you were taking drugs?
A series of madnesses, going to jail, getting out, getting hooked again, stealing, getting busted, going to jail. It was a very oppressive, restricting way to live.
Do you recall what your daily schedule would be like? I think most people, I guess myself included, think of junkies as people who are, you know, their day is completely directed. If you have to get the money and buy drugs, it's completely directed towards that goal. It's completely taken over by that. You think that's it's almost like junkies is from Mars or something. You know, I mean, were you like from a different planet in that way, or was your life pretty much like somebody else's, except that you had this additional responsibility to get drugs?
Pretty much like anybody. You know, I came from a family of seven, you know, brothers and sisters and parents, relationships with other people. You know, I laugh, cry, work, lie. You get up and have to get some money every day. It's pretty much like you're forced to get it illegally. You try not to, but you're forced to get it illegally. Yeah. And you are underground. You have to be. You're operating as an illegal person because some of your activities during that day is bound to be illegal.
Could I ask you what you had to do?
I can tell you had to steal. You know, unless you're a millionaire, I came out of Korea hooked. I joined the Army when I was 16, and I got hooked in Korea. When I got discharged from the Army, I had a habit, and I was like 20 years old. And I guess in those days, they didn't have sentence, you went to jail.
Let me ask you about your poem, the one that you wrote on the evening that you heard Malcolm X was killed. It seems in saying it was a funky deal, that what happened to Malcolm X was almost predestined, as funky deals are usually predestined, or at least you think of it. Did you think of that? And did you think of your own time in jail as almost a predestiny, like everything was leading up to it?
It's pretty much predestined in the sense that I was a young black male in America that's permeated with racism. And just the sociology of this country. If you look at most prisons, they're filled with black, Hispanic, and poor people. Now, one would have to conclude either that blacks, Hispanic, poor people are criminal-minded, they're criminals by nature, or there's something wrong with the sociology.
There's an assumption, I think, that's made a lot about not just poetry but art in general, that that an artist grows from a painful experience, such as war or jail or being a junkie. Do you think that's true? Is that true for you, or does that just make it tougher to write?
I think that pain and loneliness are some of the experiences that art draws from. That produces art, but I think there are other. I think love, for instance, produces as much. Of course, pain, loneliness, love are all common to all people. You know, I don't think that one necessarily has to be poor. For instance, that's part of that European starving addict. Thing, art for art's sake, and I don't think that one, because one is suffering, makes for good art. I think if one is going to make up art, one will make up art in spite of poverty, in spite of suffering.
You wrote yourself a poem in 1975 for your birthday. Do you remember your mood when you wrote that?
Yeah, I was living in Indianapolis at the time, and I was separated from my wife, and I live near this graveyard, Crown Hill Cemetery. It's the largest graveyard in Indianapolis, and its two most famous inhabitants are John Dillinger and James Whitcomb Riley. I mean, imagine.
Who's James Watt Riley?
James Whitcomb Riley is a poet. He's When the Frost is on the Pumpkin, he's a Midwestern American poet. And I thought it was kind of paradoxical that these would be the... they got big graves up on top of a hill, and I used to... James Whitcomb Riley, he was a good poet. I used to spend a lot of time. This particular day, I was lonely. I was alone. I was by myself, and I made up the poem. Let me say it for you. Birthday poem. The sun rose today, and the sun went down over the trees beyond the river. No crashing thunder nor jagged lightning flashed my 44 years across the heavens. I am here. I am alone with the Indianapolis news. Sitting under this Indiana sky, I lean against a gravestone and feel the warm wine on my tongue. My eyes move along the corridors of the stars, searching for a sign, for a certainty as definite as the cold concrete pressing against my back. Still the stars mock me, and the moon is my judge, but only the moon. 'Cause I ain't screwed no thumbs nor dropped no bums, though my name is naughty to the ears of some. And I ain't revealed the secrets of my brothers, though my balls have been pinched and my back's been scarred. And I ain't stopped loving nobody. Oh, I never stopped loving nobody.
You mentioned how poetry and art comes out of love. And I read in the introduction you put that in a different way about poets meddling, but I think it's connected to the same thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What did you mean by that, by poets meddling?
A poet has, the whole world is subject to this examination. If you want to examine the relationship, a fly, you know, sitting on a light bulb is as worthy as, if you want to examine what's going on with the nuclear war, if you want to examine the president, anything is a wide range. You know, and poetry is pretty democratic.
It's been really interesting speaking with you. Can I ask you to read one last poem?
Sure. Yeah, I've enjoyed. Yeah.
How about a conversation with myself? I think that.
A conversation. I spent a year poet in residence at Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri. And I used to travel quite a bit from there. This is a conversation with myself. What am I doing here in these Missouri hills, hitchhiking these highways where farmers funnel their guns and I my back? The cars zoom by, zoom, 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 and disappear around the bend. I sit on the abutment of a small bridge and wait, reading Mary Evans' book. Below me, a brook gurgles along, a field of corn, green, waving in the wind. Five cows stand, swishing their tails in the shade of three cedars. A highway cop passes and slows down, peering in his rear view mirror. I clutch. I am a black woman, like a security blanket. I turn and show my teeth and the book. The cop gasses the engine and disappears. I scramble down under the bridge and pee in the water. What am I doing here in these Missouri hills? Wish I was up in Harlem where I could talk bad.